our last chance, this session, to explore some Dharma together with words. Just a little recap, a little review. So I don't know where everybody's at with this practice that I keep harping on, keep bringing up again and again. But let's see if we can be on the same page to some extent here. Am I aware? Are you aware? Very simple, without going into some deep meditative experience. Words are coming in, thoughts are happening, sound and sensation and sights. But meanwhile, at the same time, is there an awareness of all this? Anybody not able to have a sense of the awareness of it? The ordinary awareness. Like right here and now. But it feels as if we're, in order to check, our perception shifts a little bit, just a little bit. Where our attention goes a little bit from the objects back to their source, or that which is aware. And then, how do you know that you're aware? It's the follow-up question. How do you know that you're aware? If we're sure that we are aware, what makes us so sure? What would you say?
It feels like aware. There's a feeling.
There's a feeling. But what is it that knows that we're aware? Yeah.
Just really conventionally.
Yeah.
It's been tested by experience.
What do you mean?
Since I hear the kid screaming.
Uh-huh.
And I go, there's a kid there.
That's about the objects, right?
Well, I know, but I'm aware. I'm just saying, very, I just started the conventional, very conventional.
Yeah.
I trust my awareness because it works.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It confirms, it's what knows objects.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm aware. I mean, I start trusting my awareness when it turns out to be true.
Yeah, I mean, this is now, we can veer back and forth in our discussions about the objects of awareness and the awareness, but I think in a way we could say, I know that there's kids over there because awareness is knowing them. So in a way, that's how we actually can confirm that there's kids.
If I never heard of a kid before, I might not know what I'm listening to.
Yeah.
But
where'd they go?
But I have heard that noise before, and in the past, I've confirmed it. So now I'm like, oh, I believe my awareness.
Yeah.
And that makes me say, well, that's aware. I mean, that's something, I mean, that's something.
Awareness can do that.
Yeah.
And awareness can confirm, again, that those are the kids, because that's the sound of kids. Awareness can confirm that. And again, I would say that we're kind of confirming the experience or the object. And this is this backward step of like, how can we confirm putting aside the objects? This is maybe the thing here. Putting aside the objects of the sound of the kids, how can we confirm that there is an awareness of the sound? And we might answer it that way. Well, I can confirm there's an awareness because there's a sound. Almost like, well, awareness must depend on the sound. Yeah.
I've heard you say, I'm aware that
Yeah, but how? But can you have a sense of that actual experience?
Of awareness. What came to my mind was there's that kind of a clear awareness. It was less conceptual, and then there's that kind of more of the delusional. That's sort of the two extremes, maybe. You know, the kind of all clear awareness, purity, or whatever, and then there's this delusional. Like between there, uh-huh. kind of mix.
The kind of awareness I'm speaking of is not even distinguished between clear and deluded. It's actually, it's those are more of the experiences. This is where it gets strange, because even like kind of dullness and clarity or thinking or not thinking, all these are kind of the experiential objects of awareness. And so there's an awareness of all of that, right? While I'm thinking right now, there's an awareness of the thinking, and I'm hearing, and there's an awareness of the hearing, and I'm seeing, there's an awareness of the seeing.
So you want to know the origin of awareness?
Well, more like, first can we confirm in our experience that there is an awareness of sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, thoughts, emotions, and every possible thing we could call an experience? Can we have some sense that there's a witness of those? I know, aware witnessing of every experience we've ever had.
It kind of reminds me of eyes, having eyes. You can't see your own eyes, but you know you have eyes. You know you can see.
Yeah, so in this case, we can't see, the eye can't see itself. But this case is slightly different, I would say. We know we're aware because we're having it, but then this follow-up question, I think, has a different effect, to say, well, we do feel pretty confident, don't we? I mean, I feel very confident that I'm aware right now. I think, and the awareness I'm talking about is, I think we all share that confidence, do we not? That we are aware, otherwise we're basically dead. Right, so we are aware, but now how can we know that we're aware? And we might say, like, the eye can't see itself, but this is a question with awareness. If we're so confident that we're aware, and I would propose we are 100% confident that we're aware. Unless you might not be understanding the words here, but the awareness I'm talking about is the one that we are always 100% confident when we check. And then, this follow-up question I think is quite interesting, to say, well, how can we be so sure? How can we be 100% confident? What would you say to that? And don't let it create doubt that maybe we're not aware. We are aware. And I would propose all of us know this, but how do we know it?
Children, mm-hmm. or I hear a buzzing.
Yeah.
It's a change of focus.
It's a change of focus.
From just, listening to your lecture to, okay, now I'm here with hearing the voice, the sun ray down there, the light in here.
Yes.
I'm just kind of expanded my.
Yeah, and maybe even specifically, we might even put it like the attention is usually directed towards the objects, which is every single experience, I'm calling an object, to the subject that's experiencing the object. Now that's a little bit like awareness. This is still dualistic now, right? Because there's a subject and an object. Yes.
Yeah, so maybe now I'm a little bit confused. So I like the point that Patrick brought up about kind of focusing on different aspects of awareness, almost like an attention, Like if two people are talking at the same time and I'm just trying to hear one person, then I feel like I'm like closing off awareness of what the other person is saying, even though there's this sort of background, like, okay, there's this chatter, or I understand. Maybe even if I relax enough, I can understand what both people are saying simultaneously, but if I'm trying to hear just what Richard is saying while Rachel's talking, then it's like I've got to like laser sharp narrow my attention, which seems more like a muscle, it seems more like an activity than awareness, which is maybe more passive, or whether I want it to be aware or not.
But also in this case, we can widen our laser beam from this one person's voice to multiple voices, and also then bring in sights and bodily sensations at the same time. But so now we can be aware of all of that at once, a kind of wider awareness. But still, that's all the objects. Still, right? This is a backward looking to who is aware of all, either one narrow focus or a big focus. What's the subject that's aware, and not the subject as me, the person, because it's not me, the person, actually, that's aware. It's awareness that's aware, right? Follow some?
I mean, like it seems to be bigger than everything that I'm aware of. It seems to contain it.
It seems to contain it, yep. Like a backdrop or a source, and it's totally ungraspable. If we're so used to confirming and knowing objects that this is a very unusual, the mind almost starts to get a little frazzled when looking, because we can't grasp it as an object. Awareness is like space, right? You can't grasp space. And it's like space, but it's this particular kind of space that's like a knowing space. It's like light, isn't it?
Beyond objects and beyond cause and effect.
We don't even need to get into cause and effect. We don't need to conceptualize anything about this except just like what is it that's aware of our experience right now? You know, putting aside all our thinking, everything we've ever heard, anything from any Buddhist text, in our direct experience right now, what is aware? And then the answer, of course, is awareness. So that's why to bypass the kind of looking around for who is it here? It's nothing special. It's just awareness. So that's why to ask, is awareness here, already gives us the answer of who's aware. It's awareness. But is it here? Are we aware right now? Yeah? And then, can we tune into that sense of like complete confidence that we are aware? I would say even this doesn't require any intelligence, doesn't require any Dharma practice or meditation. This is just like every sentient being on the planet, I would propose, is 100% confident that they are aware. They maybe never thought in that term, but aren't they?
Like a cat and a slug and...
Well, let's put aside other animals because without getting into complicating it, but at least in the human realm. But I would, you know, offhand, just to keep it simple, I would say, yeah, animals too know that they're aware, but they don't have the language to ever think about this. So don't we know that we're aware? And then I think to ask this question, how do we know that we're aware, has a particular effect. These questions are to, are designed to have a particular effect. Yeah. And we have to ask them really sincerely and experientially, not based on anything we've ever heard or read. How in my own experience right now do I know that I'm aware? It's a kind of investigative question. And if we get abstract, what would be the right answer? Then we're already like outside of our experience.
Well, I mean, as we've just been doing this exercise,
how do I know I'm aware? There's initially this kind of searching, this scan.
Yeah, scanning.
It's kind of curious,
mm-hmm.
a curiosity, and then I can kind of maintain that curiosity.
Mm.
It's like you mentioned trying to grab space.
Mm-hmm.
I thought of it as when you're looking sort of a cloudless sky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your eyes are wide open, but there's the muscles in our eyes try to focus on a range, on something. And when there's nothing, when there's no object to beam in on, your eyes just sort of rest in this blank focus.
That's a great image, yeah. Thank you for that.
And that's kind of the experience of, just doing this exercise right now.
Yes.
I was just sort of scanning.
Yeah, that's a good description. I can relate to that. Scanning, it's kind of a backwards scanning, right? It's like, not the objects, we're looking at the source of the objects. What is this awareness? It's like space, we can't grasp it, and yet we know that it's not nothing, right? We know that we're aware. And so it is kind of like, almost relaxing into if we're trying to do it with the laser beam attention, book, thing, time, person, if we try to do it like that, then it's too sharp a laser beam. It's more like, because the laser beam is good for specific objects, but the laser beam, to contact space with a laser beam, doesn't work so well. We need kind of like a just attentive openness. So, yes.
I'm probably just grasping here, but I think of awareness like being alive, and
mm-hmm.
And then in comparison to, like, I've had that surgery. When you're in surgery, you don't have no memory or no dream,
mm-hmm.
or a blackout even.
Yeah.
Comparatively,
yeah.
I feel like there was no awareness.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Awareness is kind of where we put our attention to.
Yeah, it's kind of like being alive. You said, yeah. It's the sense of a sense of being alive, and then it's really like we're really exploring deeply and experientially what is this sense of being alive. And I like the word awareness because it's emphasizing. It's trying not to be vague about something that's ungraspable, like space. Trying to choosing these words carefully. Awareness has a sense of like it has no dimension or graspability, and yet it's receptive, is it not? It's receiving all our experiences, doesn't it feel?
The other thing that I find interesting too is that it seems like with awareness there's a sense of time, at least, but when you're not, if you're say you get surgery or whatever, there is no sense of time. It's like you could be gone, you have a coma and wake up a year later, I think it was yesterday.
I would say that the sense of time, I agree that it seems like in awareness there's a sense of time. If we investigate very carefully on our own experience, it seems to me that the sense of time is a very subtle object of awareness.
Yeah, it reminds me of the, there's like the boat on the river and then the land, and so, you can't see that the river is moving unless you're standing on the land, you know what I mean? So it's like when you're in this place of relative stability, maybe like the backdrop of awareness, then we can see time or feel time moving through it.
Hmm.
Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah, like time. Yeah, it seems like time seems to be moving through awareness. I think that's one way of describing the experience that rings true. Time seems to be moving through it, and sounds seem to be moving through it, colors seem to be moving through it, sensations, thoughts, and feelings seem to be moving through the space of awareness, like the way that clouds move through the sky. These are all just metaphors because this is hard to talk about, right? But that's, I think, experientially, it can feel this way.
You mean like the sky's awareness?
Yeah. So I find that, is awareness present? Yes. That question has a certain effect. We have to ask it non-conceptually and ask it very sincerely as if we don't know the answer. And I find even after asking this thousands of times now, it's still a fresh question for me. It's almost like it's a stupid question, right? It's like, of course it's present, but the question has an effect. So even like, before I ask, I know the answer is going to be yes, right? But I ask it, I have to do it sincerely, which maybe after a thousand times it becomes hard to maintain the sincerity. It's like, that question again? You might feel like that. Kokyo keeps asking this again and again, but can it be a fresh asking? Is awareness present? Yes, okay. That has a certain effect. Like, my experience is different just after asking that question. It's a little bit less outer directed by asking this. It's a little more curious about the source, about the subject. And then the follow-up question, well, how can I be so sure that I'm alive, we might even say, or that awareness is present? What is it? Another way to put it, what is it that knows 100% that I'm aware? And seems to me that the experiential answer that comes is it can't be anything other than awareness that knows this. There's no other extra awareness that comes in and knows this awareness. So in a way, awareness is confirming itself. Yes.
My thought, without possibly ever being able to really ultimately answer this question, but a step in that direction, I think we're kind of talking about in different ways, is what happens when you've learned some way of stopping your mind. Now, Zazen is one way. Don Juan Matus used to teach Carlos by having it at dusk and having cross his eyes so that focus. Couldn't focus, but whatever the technique, if you learned how to stop thinking, what's left now working.
That's a great point. Yes, tricky thing is it's hard to stop thinking. But I think that's a great point that you bring up, because if we can in Zazen, even for a moment, have no thought or other. Even sensory activity happening, even. That's why I brought up before, it's like like in a sensory deprivation tank or something where there's very minimal objective input, and that still we are 100% sure that we are alive. And that's a nice, I think this nice, that's a great point, because that proves that the awareness doesn't depend on an object. Whereas, hopefully not to confuse things too much, but there's the Buddhist teaching that consciousness, which I'm defining different than awareness, consciousness is dualistic knowing.
The fifth skanda.
Yeah, the fifth skanda, vijnana. Buddhism says that does depend on an object. Consciousness, the sense faculty, the eye faculty, the eye consciousness, and the color dependently co-arise together, so that the subject and the object are interdependent. But awareness doesn't have a subject or an object. Now, I've been talking about it sort of like, it's like looking at the subject. I think that's a warm-up to the non-dual awareness. It's more, we're so object-oriented that maybe it's helpful at first to look, who is the subject? What is the subject of all these objects? What is the awareness that knows them? And this seems like the conclusion is awareness, or we might actually call it consciousness at that point. Consciousness is like a slightly distorted version of awareness, I would say. Am I aware? Am I alive? Yeah. Well, how do I know I'm alive? Well, there's something here, not out there, confirming my life. There's something that's ungraspable and intangible that's like, we might even say, is life. But life is a kind of vague, could have some vague connotations. So I think it's the awareness of everything that's happening. And it seems like this awareness, if we start to tune into it, which is hard, I admit, this is hard to tune into because it's not something that we can aim the attention at. So there it is. It's like space, but we can, you said feel it. In a way, I think we have a sense of it. And the more and more we do this exercise, the more familiar this sense is. It's not exactly like a physical feeling or a mental feeling, but maybe we could say like a knowing, or I like this word verification. There's a confidence or a verification that there is an awareness here. And again, I want to emphasize, this is not some sort of mystical, hidden thing. This is just like ordinary awareness. It's always with us constantly. But that we, I just, maybe never noticed that we're aware in this way. Yes.
Yeah. So, assuming that awareness is ever present, I feel like just kind of scanning the room, there seems to be like a toggling. I feel like I'm toggling a little bit. Like I'll look up at the light, and then the first thing it feels like is happening is that I'm focusing in on the features, like the texture, the quality of the object.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this toggling or something that sort of happens, or like a relaxation maybe, where it's fighting the backdrop or that awareness.
Mm-hmm.
It almost feels like it goes away.
The awareness, yeah.
When I focus in on something.
Yes.
And so it almost seems like an activity of like, all right, I don't have this awareness thing, and then going through those exercises to get it back.
Yep, yeah, yeah.
Like almost like riding a bike. Like,
yeah, yeah, uh-huh.
Fall this way, so I have to like recorrect.
It's a practice. Yes. And I think you said something really important too. When we're engaged in an experience, which I'm defining as attention to an object of sight, sound, smell. So we're looking at the light, and if we're really trying to focus on the light, you know, we lose touch with the awareness of the light. The awareness doesn't stop, but we're focused on the object. And then we can ask again, now we're really looking at the, yeah, there's really a light there. And now again, we did this exercise. Is awareness present? Oh, yeah! And that's why I think this term of Dogen, the backward step, is as a nice, it's just a metaphor, but it feels as if the attention is there. Is awareness present? Oh, yeah! It's back to the subject again, right? Turning the light of awareness back. And so, yeah, the more we're engaged in objects, the more we forget awareness, and we're basically always engaged in objects. But in Zazen, we simplify the situation so much. There's nothing special to look at. There's nothing special to hear. We're not being asked to attend to objects in Zazen. So it's this rare opportunity. We can attend more to the subject. If somebody says, "Hey, Kokyo," then immediately, like, I'm back out of it. And admittedly, usually in Zazen, we are thinking, and we're tending to the objects of thinking. So it's an effort, it's a practice to a subtle effort. If we come on, find the subject of awareness, that's it's too heavy-handed. It's a relaxation into, and a curiosity. And for me, these questions, maybe it will work different for different people. For me, these two questions, after all these years of practice, I'll maybe come up with find other ones that work for me in the future. But right now, these ones are like, these just like hone it down to like the essential point. Is awareness present? Yes. Very simple. How, well, why am I so sure about that? How do I know that? What is it that knows that? In a way, I feel like the second question, if the first one turns the light around, basically, the second one like hones the light that's been turned around. Or maybe it turns it back further, or I don't know how to say that, but the second one has a different effect than the first. It confirms more deeply the presence of awareness. Yes.
I don't know, but my sense of turning the light around and seeing the movie screen of the sky.
Yes.
It has a property of attenuating thinking. Is that accurate, or is that your experience?
I think this is a little bit what Andrew is saying. Like thinking or looking at an object too is when we're very object directed, then it's very hard to notice. So attenuating, which means kind of like lessening.
Yeah,
not necessarily eliminating, but
no. I mean, maybe with more practice or something, maybe it would eliminate. But it seems to. So my impression is that thinking generally is outward.
Yes.
Focused.
Thinking is total
and so,
object.
And so by like that attenuation, I become more receptive.
Yeah. But let's also remember, this is not about. It's not like we have to eliminate thinking or seeing or hearing to do this. Attenuate just means.
If you think of a dimmer switch, if I.
Dimmer.
If I look towards myself, you know, I don't know the words, but if I look at my work, what's happening, that has the effect of dimmer switch on my thoughts.
Yes. And vice versa. If you dim the thoughts, the attention can go in, and if the attention goes in, the thoughts naturally dim. Together.
Well, so I don't know if I'm just trying to understand whether this is the same thing you're talking about.
Sounds right.
Okay.
Yep.
And then the other, I think, important point is because thoughts, there's this property of thoughts, like you just agreed with, is that they're outward. Generally, they're like establishing some truth or belief from the outside of the world, or trying to please be true. And because when those reduce, that makes me more receptive.
Yeah,
I see me. You know, you're not using the word.
You as awareness.
Well, I guess that's not. I have not considered that, but I feel like I am more receptive, and my heart opens more.
Yeah,
and I can be impacted or affected things more.
Yeah,
things affect me more readily.
Yeah, I think that's right. We could say awareness is more receptive, but also I, as the person,
I haven't gotten the same word.
Yeah, even the person is more receptive. Yeah, on just a human level. Yeah, that's right, and that's this attenuation that you speak of is. Some of the language that's I've been using is the foreground background thing, right? Usually the light and the book and the thoughts is the foreground, and awareness is so far in the background that we have no sense of it at all, even though it's there. And so it's shifting the ratio, bringing awareness more like space more into the foreground, and the objects of thoughts and lights and books more into the background, which I would say is attenuation. So yeah, these are all ways of looking at it. And once again, it's not about like, if I could only stop thinking, then I could see this. That's a big pitfall, I think, right? But if I can like, if I'm totally obsessed with the thinking, then chances are very low that if I'm really involved in trying to work out the thinking, or, you know, if I'm fascinated by the thinking or any objects of experience, if I'm fascinated by an experience, that's where my energy is going. I won't be able to attend to that which is not an experience, but that which is the source of experience. So in a way, that's part of Sashini's, we're training to be less fascinated with anything that's happening. And in a way, we might say fascinated with the unborn, which maybe that's a little off because it's not fascinating, really. It's so ordinary. It's not a thing. So are we somewhat on the same page here so far?
Recap.
And so I've been thinking, and this is something we can keep working on if we're still a little bit off. And all these metaphors, it's the mirror that we're looking at that's the source of the images, it's the screen upon which the movie's playing. Now, I think all of this that we've just been talking about is like the first step. Oh no, there's more. You've heard the more part too. But I think it's nice to distinguish that I feel like this is a two-step process. And this first step, in terms of Buddhist tradition, we might call like that kind of shamatha step. It's like sometimes called shamatha without a support or shamatha without an object. And it's peaceful, it's enjoyable even, I think, when we do it. And there's a kind of confirmation of awareness. And it's a meditation practice. And then the second step is getting more curious, is starting to investigate. And I think it's not so useful to do the second step without being really like grounded in the confidence that awareness is present right now, which may be a very simple thing that we can be confident in, but like really actually shift our attention back to this confidence and awareness. So this is, and we can get more and more familiar with that, and I think just to do that practice, we could do for a very long time and get more and more steeped in it. And which is very valuable, and like you say, it makes us more receptive and all this. But the second step addresses this issue of objects. What about, we live in a world of experience and objects, and this is where our suffering arises from. This temporarily just being confident in the awareness and attenuating the thinking is a nice rest, a kind of a break from grosser forms of suffering for sure. But now we want to find a way to bring this experience into the world of activities and daily life, complex, dynamic world of objective experience. So the second step is this curiosity that's, I would say, first of all, it's investigating the awareness itself, and so the first question I like to ask is like, can I find any edges or boundaries or center, as someone brought up the other day, it's harder to do with the center. It seems like the center is located around the sense organs or something. But it's nice to see that the awareness that we're speaking of, the space, doesn't really have a center, but particularly it doesn't have edges or boundaries or limits. Again, not because we've heard this or it's and it sounds good and then it would be like space, but in our direct experience. And we might say, well, how could we possibly see that something doesn't have boundaries? And I would say it's more like the negative approach, more like, can we find any boundaries? Not so much, can we find boundarylessness? Because we can't. But can we find boundaries? Can we find edges right now in our ordinary awareness? Again, we're attenuating the objects a little bit to do this exercise. And it seems like maybe I'm getting used to this or something, but it seems like pretty quick to see that, like, how could there be any edges or boundaries to it? Now our experience, you might feel if you do this experientially, that again, there's a shift now. These are subtle shifts. Now awareness is starting to, maybe feeling the sense of its boundlessness. It's becoming like space, space-like now, like space has no edges, right? But this is a kind of knowing space. And we might say, but I don't know what's going on downtown Santa Cruz right now, so my knowing seems to have some limit. But that might be getting a little bit too conceptual. It's more like the awareness is not limited, but that way that it interacts with objects is it doesn't reach downtown. The sense faculties don't reach downtown, right? But the awareness itself, we can't even really say how far it reaches, but I think the main point is we can't find an edge or a limit to the awareness. Or can we? Do you feel like? How is that going for you? Yeah, doesn't it seem? And so then from that sense now, without losing that sense of the boundlessness of it, then this is where maybe gets tricky, because now we're going to like let that inward facing awareness, the light that's been turned around, let it start to very carefully, without losing the sense of boundless awareness, let it start looking back out carefully at the object. And that's where sound, I think, is maybe the easiest one to do with. Okay, we hear there's a little bit of bird out there now, but without getting just this direct sensory experience of the sound. We're still remembering that we are the kind of boundlessness of the space of awareness, but the sound is being experienced now in this awareness. And now the next question to ask is, where does the awareness meet that sound? And when it's it? Wait a second. I was getting really familiar with how the awareness has no edges. And if the awareness were to meet the sound, that would be kind of like an edge of awareness, wouldn't it? If there's a meeting place, that's where awareness stops and the sound begins. This might sound kind of strange, but can we sort of tune into that actual experience? Again, it's looking for the meeting place of awareness in the sound. And if we could find this meeting place, and let's not go to our concepts, and let's not go to like biology says it's where the vibrations meet the eardrum. That's just total thinking, right? In our actual experience, can we find the meeting place of the space of awareness and the sound? And when I look for that, again, a shift happens, right? It's like, I can't find the meeting place. It's like awareness itself. It's like one awareness is this boundless field or ocean of unborn awareness. It's like it is completely permeated by the sound of the bird. The sound of the bird fills every nook and cranny of awareness, doesn't it seem like? It's not just over in the ear area. Isn't it? Can you feel, have some sense? In other words, the sound is permeated by the awareness and the awareness is permeated by the sound. They don't meet. They are one seamless whole. Can you follow? I lost. Yeah. Yes.
More of like the receptiveness I talked about before. It's more like love or I love the bird or I receive the bird or you know, some kind of feeling like that. I don't have it.
Receive, but we're not even talking about the bird, right? We're just talking about a sound.
Sound.
We have to be really like honing on. Yeah, and I think love is part of this.
Yeah.
So it may be the same thing that we're talking about is like, but not love in a like. There doesn't have to be a kind of emotional thing, and not about the bird, because as soon as if we move from the sound to it must be a bird, now we're into conceptual thinking, right? We're just the sound. But I think there is a love in the sense that I think when there's the seamless space that actually is one with its objects of experience, one with every experience, I think love is a name for this. It's love is like a completely open-heartedness. So you may be onto something. Yes.
It seems like, stay away from the word experience, but I've suspended my desire to grasp onto this field. So I'm not sort of building a story. When you said bird, I actually didn't hear anything. So I was aware of immediately going out to search, search for something.
Yeah.
And when I stopped that, and willing to just sit in this, be in this space.
Yeah.
So I've suspended my kind of grasping and figuring out.
Yes.
I've suspended my going out and meeting that bird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm saying I here because
Yeah.
It still seems like I am doing this exercise. And
Yeah, this is a great point. First of all, the first point is that I think this is a nice point that we're not going out looking for objects to kind of like to apply to this practice. It's more like there's constantly objects coming, and if it's not the bird, it's a sight or something else or a feeling or a thought. It's like whatever is coming, we're just receptive to that. We're not going out and looking, because if we start going out looking for an object to kind of test out with this, then we'll probably lose the sense of spaciousness. But it is like a receptive openness is the space. And then the sound seems to fill that space. And then this particular investigation of not finding the meeting place is, I would say, is a way of, maybe clumsy way of talking about non-duality. If the object and the subject are not two things, awareness is the sound of the bird. The sound of the bird is awareness, or the sound of the bird is made of awareness. Awareness, in a way, is maybe we could even say made of the sound of the bird. They're inseparable, and this is love. And then the second point is, doesn't it seem that we're doing this kind of mental gymnastics sometimes? Like, did Rachel bring this up yesterday? Or, yes?
When we were talking.
Yeah. I think that's true. I think this is like specific exercises, and you could say it's like, it seems almost like mind tricks or something, right? And yet, I agree with that, actually. I think these are specific tools, just like following the breath is a kind of a little mind trick. Keeping an upright posture is a little bit of a mind-body trick. We're willing to actually somewhat contrive some practices in order to then arrive at an uncontrived reality. And I think, so they're tools, they're methods. And then I would say when we're actually start to taste the sound of the bird and the boundless awareness are one boundless unborn space. Therefore, the sound of the bird is the unborn too now, right? Awareness is taking the shape of what we call sound. What is sound? At this point, I have no idea what sound is anymore, right? It's kind of a non-conceptual. And we've arrived at an uncontrived experience, an uncontrived reality, an uncontrived presence. And then we have these words, well, what about all the Kazon saying, you must experience this one time. And if you have this sense of that the sound of the bird and the unborn space being one taste, one reality, then excuse me, Kazon, for saying so, but I think this is what he's talking about. We've just had the one experience of like complete enlightenment, but just for one moment. No separation, boundless openness. So, just one more point is that then what is all this stuff about the one experience of enlightenment and so on? And I think this is Rachel's question. There's something around this. I put this in my own words, but tell me if this was kind of a gist. I interpreted it as something like, is there any difference if we verify, that's my word, but if we verify unborn awareness one time or many times, or verify that we haven't verified it? Was it something like that? So, is there any difference? And I hesitated, and I think gave a kind of sloppy response. Because I thought it's a tricky question. On the surface, it might seem really obvious, but because I thought from the perspective of the unborn awareness, there is no difference, right? The unborn awareness that's always present, it's not different if somebody realizes enlightenment or they don't, right? If somebody recognizes itself or doesn't recognize it, from its point of view, there's no difference, right? That's what the unborn is. There is no differences in the unborn. There's just the manifestations of appearances. In other words, for the screen, is there any difference between a horror movie and a love story? No, right? For the screen, there's no difference. So that's it's which point of view we're talking about. From the point of view of the screen or the unborn, there's no difference. But from the human or practical perspective, then there's a huge difference. Because in one case that I wrote was confirming, verifying the unborn gives us a reliable and trustworthy refuge. And not confirming it leaves us in doubt and not knowing what to ultimately rely on or trust. And we could say, from a human practical perspective, and which is in a way what all this Buddha Dharma is about, is trying to relieve human suffering. From that point of view, then one is knowing the way to be free, and one's actually not knowing how to be free, but trying sometimes. Even one Kazon's one moment of experience, we're not, and then when we lose that, we're not free anymore, but now we know the way to be free. Does that make sense? And then you could say that's Buddha nature. We're just like, we're completely in accord with Buddha nature, but then there's a whole lifetime, maybe many, many lifetimes we could say strengthening the trust that there's nothing other than this, Buddha nature, and there's no other practices that are as complete as this, in a way. And so not kind of like, well, that's nice, but let me look for something else now. How about the eight jhanas? It's like, no, don't go there. We found it now. I mean, this is my just wrap here, so anyone can find any practice, but this is, well, I want to, put all my eggs in this basket. But that's not all, deepening the trust in it, but then applying it, right? We only have these little momentary, times when the sound of the bird is the awareness and there's nothing inside or outside anymore. Then we want to like bring that into like reading a book, cooking a meal, driving a car, like having an argument. Like, and this is endless, right? Although I think they say the Buddha finished one story. Some say the Buddha can't finish this. Because every situation is a new situation. So this application part is and maybe we extend the momentary glimpse before we're like, attention, wow, it's so free and okay here. There's nothing lacking and nothing extra. And then like, isn't it time for lunch? So like, attention goes back out to the, I gotta do something. And so then, okay, that's normal. And then like, let's remember again, let's sit some zazen. Are we all like, maybe if not on the same page, in the same book?
I'm on the same poem of Trust in Mind.
That's
the
it.
First line, it serves like what we've been talking about the whole time.
The way is not difficult.
Thoughts arise,
yeah.
The way is simple.
And we might, in terms of this, I might even edit it a little bit and say, even if discriminating thoughts arise, if we recognize their source, the host of these, as the unborn awareness, then the way is easy too. So yeah, we don't have to stop anything in these non-dual practices. So it's probably getting late, but yes.
When I heard Rich's question yesterday, I was wondering if enlightenment was sort of like, well, take this one, but it was that judge definition of pornography, I know it when I see it. You know, this kind of thing, if you have to ask, or sometimes people say if you can't afford it, you have to ask how much it is, you can't afford it. You know, one of those is it something like that?
Yeah, and maybe I know it when I see it, like maybe there's some qualities that go with it, like if it's like, well, I guess this is enlightenment, but I hate everybody and I feel totally lacking and like all kind of annoyed, then like, and I really am, then maybe that doesn't look like quite like it. So I think these qualities of peace and freedom from striving and suffering and greed, hate, and delusion in that moment, right? I think these, and those are the ones we care about. We actually, these mental gymnastics or whatever, it's all to be free from greed, hate, and delusion and suffering, right? So, we know it when we see it, and this point about experience, and how experience seems to always be the coming and going objects on the screen of unborn awareness that doesn't come and go. So is enlightenment an experience? This is where I think I've been trying to investigate these questions in the last day or so. And I think it's another level of subtlety that, and I think it's hard to talk about, but, I'm liking this word that Dogen likes. When he talks about enlightenment, he uses the word sho, right? The Japanese sho means to verify or confirm. So practice and verification are not two, is one of Dogen's classic things. And I think it's a good one because verification, I think, does not have to be conceptual. So even back at this first step of the exercise, we can say awareness verifies that it is aware. Awareness knows that it's aware, but know might be a loaded word, but awareness can non-conceptually verify that it is aware. And you can say awareness is verifying that it's aware all the time, actually. And then, but what about me? What about, as a person, do we know that that's happening? And we have this whole chant where Dogen says, all this, however, doesn't appear within perception because it's unconstructedness, and so on. But when we talk about enlightened experience, maybe I'm trying to kind of work out a way of talking about this, but I could say, like, the non-conceptual verification kind of seeps into a conceptual verification. And the conceptual verification is not quite it, actually. But it has, there's some correlation. So, another word that Andrew brought up to me was perfume. So like, and the old texts sometimes use that term too. It's like, you could say the actual non-conceptual reality of awareness confirming itself emanates a kind of perfume, like a scent of a subtle scent, wafts into the conceptual world of experience. In other words, like a scent of the screen starts to percolate into the movie. Of course, the movie is made of the screen, right? But the movie doesn't notice the screen that it's playing on. But maybe sometimes the screen, perfume's nice because it's so intangible, right? What is a smell? You can't grab a smell, but we notice it. It's an experience that kind of comes, like the character in the movie's like, do I smell a screen around here? Wait a second. Screens all around me. Actually, like I'm on the screen. There's the reflection on the mirror. I smell a mirror. So it's a little clunky, I know, but and I think that the conceptual verification is a kind of simulation in a way, right? It's not exactly the real thing. It's somewhat artificial, and yet it's closely interwoven. It's so interwoven more than any other experience. It seems to be directly pointing to the non-conceptual reality. Yeah. I mean, all of, you could say intimacy could apply to lots of parts of this conversation. You could say that the awareness confirming itself is an intimacy. Also, when the boundless space of awareness is one with the sound of the bird, there's no meeting place. The sound of the bird is made of the awareness. That's an intimacy. That's maybe even the main intimacy of non-duality. And then you could say when the perfume of that non-dual intimacy starts wafting into our experience or our world of concept, and like, that's it. That's what the Buddhas and ancestors are like, are speaking. This sounds just like what Kazan's talking about. I'd say, and that's like, not quite it, right? But it is a little bit like, I think it's important, and that's a kind of an intimacy too. Yeah. Yeah, we can't even name the awareness as something. Yeah, so intimacy is this whole, the whole thing is actually a kind of just non-conceptual presence. So I'm just kind of like unpacking this in this highly conceptual way, right, with these multiple steps and exercises. because for me, I actually find it's helpful. Because for myself, otherwise things can become vague. And we sometimes do actually just open to the intimacy, but then we're like, then people say, it's just grace. I don't know what that is. But this is like, and then, well, how do I find my way back there? It's like, I don't know. I just keep sitting and wait for it to happen again. It's a slow, if we just keep waiting, it may be kind of slower, but these are like some tools to kind of like wriggle in to this, so that we're not just kind of waiting. We can actually like, it's the little key, the little access keys, I feel like. And there's many. Zen, you could say all the Zen teachings are all access keys to the treasure store that will actually open of itself, and then you will use it at will. So it's late, but this is the last talk, and I just want to finish yesterday's story, which I feel like the maybe my favorite section so far in the sesshin. It's a sweet one, and maybe now we can confirm. Sounds like this one taste is what Kazan's talking about. Maybe.
And we're, just to, so we're on the same page, we're on Mishaka.
Mishaka.
And what was the main case?
Oh, the main case was, which he barely mentions in this last rest here, but the case was the fifth ancestor, Dhirtaka, said to Mishaka, quoting the Buddha, the Buddha said, practicing wizardry and studying the trivial is like being dragged around by a rope. So that's when I say, in a way, maybe sometimes I can get into the spirit of even any other practices than this, just confirming that awareness is aware of itself and that everything is made of awareness. Sometimes I feel like everything else is trivial to this, but especially wizardry and sorcery. You yourself should know that if you leave the small stream and immediately come to the great ocean, you will verify, it's that word show here, you will verify the unborn. Hearing this, Mishaka experienced. Actually, the Japanese just says, hearing this, it was daigo, which means great realization. There's no word experience here. Experienced awakening, but really it's just understood directly. So Kazan now says, I heard some of this yesterday, don't you realize that when someone calls, you respond, and when someone points with a finger, you follow? This does not occur through discriminating judgment or through a conscious effort. It's the working of the host. So specifically we could say, when we're just responding naturally and spontaneously to conditions, it's not so much that we have to actually do anything, that the manifestations of all experiences are the workings of the host, which is the boundless, unborn, ungraspable awareness. That when somebody says, look over there, and we look, it's like, oh, I did that. Especially in a simple thing like that, it's like, I didn't even do it. Well, how did it happen? It's just the host expressing itself as activity, natural activity. This host, now it's a little description of the host. Maybe it sounds familiar now. The host has neither face nor bodily characteristics. However, he never stops moving. So in some ways we could say the host actually never moves, but this is expressing the way that the unborn, unmoving host is dynamic activity at the same time. The host never rejects the sounds of the moving birds. The host is the sound of the moving birds. The host is people walking around. The host never stops moving. Because of this, mind, capital and mind arises as what is called body. When the body appears, the four great elements, the five aggregates, the myriad skin pores, the 360 bones come together, and you are a body.
I see that as that, you know, when you said, you know, there's that bird there, and I sort of, you know, then crystallized again into this focus. Mm-hmm. Where is that?
Yeah.
And is that what he's saying there? That then I went from awareness
to an experience.
To experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So we could hear, we might even say, in a deep samadhi, there aren't 360 bones. They actually aren't there, really, from this point of view. But then, as soon as as soon as awareness says yes to experience, then one of the first ones is the body. And we might say, why does it keep happening that way? And it's the same number of bones when I wake up every morning. and say, that's the mysterious workings of cause and effect. And it's not of the movie. The movie plays out in this particular plot, you know. And I think Buddhism is very, very good at explaining the workings of dependent co-arising and how things function and how we do wake up each day with the appearance of the same number of bones. And yet, could still say all of that is still the realm of the movie. But the movie has laws. But this is called the conventional truth. Dependent co-arising is like the conventional truth. And the unborn is like the ultimate truth. So, mind arises as what's called, quote, body. When the body appears, the four elements, the five aggregates, all these things arise, and you are a body. We might even say you here as awareness. You are a body. Not so much that the awareness has a body, but the awareness now is a body in the sense that awareness is the sound of the bird. When the it's like a jewel manifesting light, or a sound manifesting an echo. From birth to death, you lack nothing and have nothing in excess. With such a birth and death, though you as a person are born, your birth has no beginning. Though you as a person die, your death leaves no traces. We appear to be born and die, but the unborn doesn't. It's like the waves rising and falling on the ocean, leaving no traces. The body and the birth and death are like waves rising and falling in the ocean of awareness. Even though the waves disappear, they don't go to any particular place. Because the ocean is what it is, large or small waves appear and disappear. Your own mind is the same. It moves without ever stopping and therefore appears as skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. It functions as the four great elements and five aggregates. It also appears in the form of peach blossoms and green bamboo. So this is a nice point that awareness appears as what we might think of as the subject of the body, and awareness also appears as the objects of peach blossoms and green bamboo. It appears as eyeballs and flowers that are seen by them, right? All appearing out of the same unborn. It verifies it. Now we're talking about is the unborn. It's going to show here. It verifies, confirms enlightenment or satori. In the form of attaining the way and clarifying the mind, it divides into sounds and forms, and is different in the forms of seeing and hearing. Or it appears to be different. But it is just the one host. It functions as wearing clothes and eating food and as speech and action and karma. Dividing and dividing and dividing, it is nevertheless not separated itself. Nicely pointing to this, isn't it? Appearing and appearing and appearing, it's not limited by any physical characteristics. It resembles a magician performing various magical illusions, like producing images in a dream. Even though 10,000 images go through 1,000 changes and 10,000 transformations in the face of a mirror, it is just this one single mirror. If you do not know this and vainly cultivate wizardry or study the trivial, there's no chance for liberation. Monks, you are not in bondage, so how can you become newly liberated? That's a good point. Delusion and enlightenment are originally non-existent. You're free of bondage and liberation from the beginning. The unborn isn't actually liberated or in bondage, right? It just is what it is. You're free of bondage and liberation from the beginning. Isn't this the unborn? Isn't this the great ocean? Where are there any small streams? Lands as numerous as grains of dust or atoms are all the ocean of the Dharma Dhatu, or the whole universe. Dharma Dhatu is this dynamic term that could have a whole talk in itself, but the sometimes just the whole universe, we say, the Dharma Dhatu, and sometimes it's sometimes translated as the basic space of all things, of all phenomena. It's one translation of Dharma Dhatu. The basic space means the basis that is space of all things. So it's something that this relationship of like all things are made of space, something like this. And lands as numerous as grains of dust are themselves the ocean of the Dharma Dhatu. The flowing of valley streams, cascading waterfalls, and swirling rivers are all the lively turning of the great ocean. So there's no small stream to leave, no great ocean to seize. This being such, all of Michaka's difficulties went away of themselves, and his former views were taken care of in one blow, and he gave up wizardry and left home. This is an expression of karmic affinity. This is the story of his karmic affinity with his teacher. What is more, when you practice and practice and practice in this way, here the word practice is san, like dokusan, which literally means like meeting. So we could say when you meet and meet and meet without meeting anything separate. And there is agreement between mind and words, it will truly be like intimate friends meeting, or the self nodding to the self, verifying itself. You will all swim together in the ocean of true nature and never be separated for even an instant. If you're influenced in such a way, or if you intuit in such a way, it must be the manifestation of karmic affinity. Don't you see? Great Master Ma, Matsu, said, No sentient being for countless eons has ever left the samadhi of Dharma nature. We had a session on Dogen's Dharma nature samadhi fascicle at one point. Dharmata is another, sometimes synonym with Dharma Dhatu. Dharmata is like the suchness of Dharma's, Dharma-ness. Also synonym of ta-ta-ta, thusness. So the Dharma nature samadhi is the absorption in the nature, the true nature of things, the unborn. So Matsu said, all sentient beings for countless eons have never left this Dharma nature samadhi. In this Dharma nature samadhi, they wear clothes and eat food, talk together and reply. The functioning of the six senses and the carrying out of activities is nothing but this Dharma nature, Matsu said. Hearing this, do not take it as meaning that sentient beings exist within Dharma nature. Here's his last subtle point, sweet one. Is it that the sound of the bird is happening in the unborn awareness? That's pretty good. That's I think, closer than the sound of the bird is somewhere out there, and I'm over here hearing it. But even to say that it's sound of the bird is within the space of awareness is a little bit dualistic, right? It's like the furniture in the room is not the same as the room. So this is a subtlety that Kazan saying, hearing all this, do not take it to mean that sentient beings exist within the Dharma nature, or the unborn. Whether you say Dharma nature or sentient beings, it's the same as saying water and waves. There's no difference. Therefore, we may use words like water and waves, but how can there be any difference? So the body, the thoughts, the world do not really appear within the unborn awareness. The body, the mind, and the world are the unborn awareness. This morning, in order to say something definitive about this story, I have a humble verse. Want to hear it?
Yes.
Even with purity, like autumn waters reaching to the horizon, how can it compare with the haziness of a spring night's moon? Many people desire to find purity in their lives, but though they sweep and sweep, their minds are not yet empty. In other words, we don't have to polish this mirror again and again to get rid of the dust. We don't have to sweep and sweep away all the thoughts and painful emotions to empty the mind. It's all it. Even with purity, like the autumn waters reaching to the horizon, this sense of like total serenity, how can that compare with the hazy spring night moon? Many people wish to find this purity, but though they sweep and sweep, they can't empty their minds. Just one final word from on this verse from Lex Hickson. He says, Master Kazan's closing poem this morning warns us not to misperceive the landscape of the unborn. It's not a clear autumn moon. It's not the beginning of winter hibernation. Leaves are not drying up and falling away to expose black limbs against cold sky. Unborn nature is the hazy moon of spring. Life is burgeoning. There's a cloud of tender new growth floating about the trees. Mist veils the moon, concealing its form while revealing its most subtle light. Air is humid. soil is damp, dark, and fragrant. Sitting before dawn, blackness becomes light. Can this broom sweep the earth away? Can this cup empty the vast ocean?
Maybe this is reflecting what I was just feeling is, it's sometimes, I listen to this, and sometimes it seems reductive. In the same way that, you know, the Buddha says, I'm not going to be born again. It's really like, thank God I don't have to have a life. And there's this idea that life is horrible and I'm getting out of there. Sometimes that's what it sounds like to me. And then I say reductive in the sense that that beautiful thing about the blossoms and the bamboo is the same thing as, I don't know, whatever else it was. It's sort of like
the 306 bones.
Yeah. It's sort of like, yeah, why even bother? I mean, it's all the same, and, you know, it's all this one big nugget of rock, and you know, but it's so, just because I was feeling that way, and I heard that last poem.
Yeah.
He sort of said, yeah, actually, life is worth living.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I got from that.
That's the point.
Yeah, right. I'm just.
Yeah.
I guess I'm.
Mm-hmm. It's not, reductive would be somehow if we have to sweep away every experience of life and just be the unborn with nothing happening in it, that would be quite dualistic. But there are practices, some people, like you say, even in the Buddhist tradition, we can hear stories like, that would be the best if nothing's happening but the unborn. But Zen is like, you know, let's celebrate the myriad manifestations of the unborn and all their like mucky dampness, molding, blossoming, composting. What's that?
Can you sweep away?
Yeah, we can't, and what a shame it would be to try.
Yeah, so I mean, that's like in people, it's like, you know, I go to these retreats, like, or something. So I say, well, so I can enjoy my life more.
Yeah.
Not like.
Well, good answer to them.
Yeah, right. But I just.
You might even say, so I can enjoy the muck more.
Well, yeah, I would say muck's fun to enjoy. it's that it just like, you know, this idea, oh, here's the answer, it's all done. That's a little. I think that I resist that kind of tone.
Done might be the beginning of our true life.
It's all figured out, and here it is, and stuff like that.
But even if we have some strong confirmation that muck is the unborn, and the unborn is the muck, then some might call that a certain kind of doneness. Like when Dogen came back from China, he said, I've completed my life's work. But that was the beginning of his life's work. That's when he started writing the Shobogenzo, right? So there's certain, that kind of language. Done doesn't mean then we just die. Done can sometimes mean we've really come to the conclusion, this is how it is, and now let's live in this way.
Yeah. I guess it leads back to the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a little bit. I mean, if everything is like science still delivers, it's like what? I mean, what's the point?
Sometimes enlightenment or verification is talked about like that. No doubt. Maybe if we want to not grab it too sealed and delivered, we could say no more doubt. But if it's like, well, the mystery, I still have a lot of doubts to work out. Well, then there's like. That's our work, right? But at some point we can have clarified all doubt, but then we begin our true work. Does that make sense? There's a done.
There's always more stuff to do.
Well, there's a doneness in terms of understanding.
Yeah.
I think we could say.
Is there?
I would say so. And when the unborn verifies the unborn, understanding is. complete, I could say. And then there's a lot of work to do. But it's not about trying to figure out, it's not about trying to figure out reality anymore. It maybe is about like celebrating reality in hundreds of different Dharma teachings and coming from different angles so we don't get stuck in just Kazan's version.
I just thought of, there was a comedian who used to, he was the husband of Roxanne. What was that guy's, what's that guy's
name? John Goodman.
No, that was on the show.
Jane Wilder.
No, that's, it's alright. Whoever the guy was, Tom's right.
Now we're into it.
This is Tom Arnold. I saw him, he was talking, he was a friend. This, he gets into this point, he says, he was talking about his wife. And he says, if I waited to be enlightened to get married, no one would get married. He was saying, if you waited to be enlightened before you're married, no one would get married. So, you know, somehow there's something in there.
But can we say that we finally are able to trust this ground?
Yes. Yeah.
And so we completely trust it.
Yeah.
That could be the finality.
Yeah.
But then the process
continues
to unfold.
Yes.
With that same degree of trust.
How about that? Is that
true for you? I was to bring it up. You know, it's not an answer to it, really. It's just expressing my I was feeling this way, and it's
mm-hmm. fun. Yeah, I think it's a good point that if the nice neat conceptual package is all wrapped up, we might say that's nice too, but that's not so much the point as the trust, and we can say. Maybe we do. Maybe we wrap up Kazan. We got you, Kazan. We're on board with you for now. And but then tomorrow, let's take up Nagarjuna. He's got a different angle on the same thing. He's got a different way of talking. So then we have another conceptual package that'll take us even longer to wrap up. But maybe the same trust can permeate through all the Dharma explorations. Like, what beautiful story from Shoto Harada Roshi, heard that he, was really struggling in his practice for, pushing harder and harder, really trying to get something in sesshin after sesshin on his own. And at some point, he, somebody pointed out, you're so like blessed to be able to like do so many sesshins. I have all this other stuff I have to do. And suddenly this like burden opened up and he's like, wow, I am blessed. And it was like, apparently he'd been sitting enough that it opened up into like a complete kind of awakening. And he said, all my burdens dropped away. It was like, somebody just pointed out how fortunate I was. And it was my awakening. And he said, then everything was different. And he said, I was still working on these beginning koans, and I still had to go through this whole system of unpacking these koans, but it was all from the place of this trust now. It wasn't like, I have to, like, I don't get it, and I have to get it, and it's more like, we just have a new, each koan is a new jewel to, or a new facet of the jewel to, into the unborn. A new window into the unborn. So, we conclude another year of transmission of light stories. And as we have discussed, it's hard to arrange our lives to come and sit like this. And there's a lot of stuff going out there, important stuff to take care of, and it's hard to find the time to not pay attention to all that stuff and look inward. So let's rejoice in our sincere bodhicitta that drags us to this hall once again, and let's package up all our positive energy that we've gathered, seal it up, tie it with a bow, and throw it into the Dharma Dhatu, where it may explode into billions of jewel candy raining down on all sentient beings, so the cats and the dogs bark and meow wildly, and the trees sing hallelujah. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.